They did, I say. I'm stunned and surprisingly moved, thinking of the baker telling this to Peter. It strikes me that my own reluctance to sing, my own dismissal of music, might not really be that I think it's a waste of time. It might be because it reminds me too much of my father. So that day, in music assembly, the teacher asked who knew the Valley Song. Your hand shot right up in the air. She stood you up on a stool and had you sing it for us. And I swear, every bird outside the windows fell silent, Peter says. Oh, please, I say, laughing. No, it happened. And right when your song ended, I knew, just like your mother, I was a goner, Peter says. Then, for the next 11 years, I tried to work up the nerve to talk to you. Without success, I add. Without success. So, in a way, my name being drawn in the reaping was a real piece of luck, says Peter. For a moment, I'm almost foolishly happy, and then confusion sweeps over me, because we're supposed to be making up this stuff, playing at being in love, not actually being in love. But Peter's story has a ring of truth to it, that part about my father and the birds. And I did sing the first day of school, although I don't remember the song. And that red plaid dress, there was one, a hand-me-down to Prim that got washed to rags after my father's death. It would explain another thing, too, why Peter took a beating to give me the bread on that awful hollow day. So if those details are true, could it all be true? You have a remarkable memory, I say haltingly. I remember everything about you, says Peter, tucking a loose strand of hair behind my ear. You're the one who wasn't paying attention. I am now, I say. Well, I don't have much competition here, he says. I want to draw away, to close those shutters again, but I know I can't. It's as if I can hear Haymitch whispering in my ear. Say it! Say it! I swallow hard and get the words out. You don't have much competition anywhere. And this time, it's me who leans in. Our lips have just barely touched when the clunk outside makes us jump. My bow comes up, the arrow ready to fly. But there's no other sound. Peter peers through the rocks and then gives a whoop. Before I can stop him, he's out in the rain, then handing something in to me. A silver parachute attached to a basket. I rip it open at once, and inside there's a feast. Fresh rolls, goat cheese, apples, and best of all, a tureen of that incredible lamb stew on wild rice. The very dish I told Caesar Flickerman was the most impressive thing the capital had to offer. Peter wriggles back inside, his face lit up like the sun. I guess Haymitch finally got tired of watching us starve. I guess so, I answer. But in my head, I hear Haymitch's smug, if slightly exasperated, words. Yes, that's what I'm looking for, sweetheart. Chapter 23. Every cell in my body wants me to dig into the stew and cram it, handful by handful, into my mouth. But Peter's voice stops me. We better take it slow on that stew. Remember the first night on the train? The rich food made me sick, and I wasn't even starving then. You're right, and I could just inhale the whole thing, I say regretfully, but I don't. We are quite sensible. We each have a roll, half an apple, and an egg-sized serving of stew and rice. I make myself eat the stew in tiny spoonfuls. They even sent us silverware and plates, savoring each bite. When we finish, I stare longingly at the dish. I want more. Me too. Tell you what, we wait an hour, If it stays down, then we get another serving, Peter says. Agreed, I say. It's going to be a long hour. Maybe not that long, says Peter. What was that you were saying just before the food arrived? Something about me, no competition, best thing that ever happened to you? I don't remember that last part, I say, hoping it's too dim in here for the cameras to pick up my blush. Oh, that's right. That's what I was thinking, he says. Scoot over. I'm freezing. I make room for him in the sleeping bag. We lean back against the cave wall, my head on his shoulder, his arms wrapped around me. I can feel Haymitch nudging me to keep up the act. So, since we were 5, you never even noticed any other girls? I ask him. No, I noticed just about every girl, but none of them made a lasting impression but you, he says. I'm sure that would thrill your parents, you liking a girl from the seam, I say. Hardly, but I couldn't care less. Anyway, if we make it back, you won't be a girl from the seam. You'll be a girl from the Victor's Village, he says. That's right. If we win, we'll each get a house in the part of town reserved for Hunger Games victors. Long ago, when the games began, the capital had built a 12 fine houses in each district. Of course, in ours, only one is occupied. Most of the others have never been lived in at all. A disturbing thought hits me. But then, our only neighbor will be Haymitch. Ah, that'll be nice, says Peter, tightening his arms around me. You, me, and Haymitch, very cozy. Picnics, birthdays, long winter nights around the fire, retelling old Hunger Games tales. I told you, he hates me, I say, but I can't help laughing at the image of Haymitch becoming my new pal. Only sometimes. When he's sober, I've never heard him say one negative thing about you, says Peter. He's never sober, I protest. That's right. Who am I thinking of? Oh, I know. It's Cinna who likes you. But that's mainly because you didn't try to run when he set you on fire, says Peter. On the other hand, Haymitch? Well, if I were you, I'd avoid Haymitch completely. He hates you. I thought you said I was his favorite, I say. He hates me more, says Peter. I don't think people, in general, are his sort of thing. I know the audience will enjoy our having fun at Haymitch's expense. He has been around so long, he's practically an old friend to some of them. And after his head dive off the stage at the Reaping, everybody knows him. By this time, they'll have dragged him out of the control room for interviews about us. No telling what sort of lies he's made up. He's at something of a disadvantage because most mentors have a partner, another victor to help them, whereas Haymitch has to be ready to go into action at any moment. Kind of like me when I was alone in the arena. I wonder how he's holding up with the drinking, the attention, and the stress of trying to keep us alive. It's funny. Haymitch and I don't get along well in person, but maybe Peter is right about us being alike. Because he seems able to communicate with me by the timing of his gifts. Like how I knew I must be close to water when he withheld it, and how I knew the sleep syrup just wasn't something to ease Peter's pain, and how I know now that I have to play up the romance. He hasn't made much effort to connect with Peter, really. Perhaps he thinks a bowl of broth would just be a bowl of broth to Peter. Whereas I'll see the strings attached to it. A thought hits me, and I'm amazed the question's taken so long to surface. Maybe it's because I've only recently begun to view Haymitch with a degree of curiosity. How do you think he did it?
Who did what?
Peter asks. Haymitch, how do you think he won the games? I say. Peter considers this. Quite a while before he answers. Haymitch is sturdily built,
but no physical wonder like Cato or Thresh. He's not particularly handsome, not in the way that causes sponsors to rain gifts on you. And he's so surly it's hard to imagine anyone teaming up with him. There's only one way Haymitch could have won, and Peeta says it just as I'm reaching this conclusion myself.
He outsmarted the others, says Peeta.
I nod, then let the conversation drop. But secretly, I'm wondering if Haymitch sobered up long enough to help Peeta and me, because he thought we just might have the wits to survive. Maybe he wasn't always a drunk. Maybe in the beginning, he tried to help the tributes, but then it got unbearable. It must be hell to mentor two kids and then watch them die, year after year after year. I realize that if I get out of here, that will become my job, to mentor the girl from District 12. The idea is so repellent, I thrust it from my mind. About half an hour has passed before I decide I have to eat again. Peeta's too hungry himself to put up an argument. While I'm dishing up two more small servings of lamb stew and rice, we hear the anthem begin to play. Peeta presses his eyes against a crack in the rocks to watch the sky. There won't be anything to see tonight, I say, far more interested in the stew than the sky. Nothing's happened, or we would have heard a cannon.
Katniss, Peeta says quietly.
What, should we split another roll, too? I ask.
Katniss, he repeats, but I find myself wanting to ignore him.
I'm going to split one, but I'll save the cheese for tomorrow, I say. I see Peeta staring at me.
What?
Thresh is dead, says Peeta.
He can't be, I say.
They must have fired the cannon during the thunder and we missed it, says Peeta.
Are you sure? I mean, it's pouring buckets out there. I don't know how you can see anything, I say.
I push him away from the rocks and squint out into the dark, rainy sky. For about 10 seconds, I catch a distorted glimpse of Thresh's picture, and then he's gone. Just like that. I slump down against the rocks, momentarily forgetting about the task at hand. Thresh dead. I should be happy, right? One less tribute to face, and a powerful one, too. But I'm not happy. All I can think about is Thresh letting me go, letting me run because of Rue, who died with that spear in her stomach.
You all right? Asks Peeta.
I give a non-committal shrug and cup my elbows in my hands, hugging them close to my body. I have to bury the real pain, because who's going to bet on a tribute who keeps sniveling over the deaths of her opponents? Rue was one thing. We were allies. She was so young, but no one will understand my sorrow at Thresh's murder. The word pulls me up short. Murder. Thankfully, I didn't say it out loud. That's not going to win me any points in the arena. What I do say is, it's just, if we didn't win, I wanted Thresh to, because he let me go, and because of Rue.
Yeah, I know, says Peeta, but this means we're one step closer to District 12.
He nudges a plate of food into my hands.
Eat. It's still warm.
I take a bite of the stew to show I don't really care, but it's like glue in my mouth and takes a lot of effort to swallow. It also means Cato will be back hunting us.
And he's got supplies again, says Peeta.
He'll be wounded, I bet, I say.
What makes you say that? Peeta asks.
Because Thresh would never have gone down without a fight. He's so strong. I mean, he was. And they were in his territory, I say.
Good, says Peeta. The more wounded Cato is, the better. I wonder how Foxface is making out.
Oh, she's fine, I say peevishly. I'm still angry she thought of hiding in the cornucopia and I didn't. Probably be easier to catch Cato than her.
Maybe they'll catch each other and
we can just go home, says Peeta. But we better be extra careful about the watches. I dozed off a few times.
Me too, I admit. But not tonight.
We finish our food in silence, and then Peeta offers to take the first watch. I burrow down in the sleeping bag next to him, pulling my hood up over my face to hide it from the cameras.
I just need a few moments of privacy where I can let any emotion cross my face without being seen.
Under the hood, I silently say goodbye to Thresh and thank him for my life. I promise to remember him, and if I can, do something to help his family and Ruse if I win. Then I escape into sleep, comforted by a full belly and the steady warmth of Peeta beside me. When Peeta wakes me later, the first thing I register is the smell of goat cheese. He's holding out half a roll spread with the creamy white stuff and topped with apple slices.
Don't be mad, he says. I had to eat again. Here's your half.
Oh, good, I say, immediately taking a huge bite. The strong, fatty cheese tastes just like the kind Prim makes. The apples are sweet and crunchy.
Mmm.
We make a goat cheese and apple tart at the bakery, he says.
Bet that's expensive, I say. Too expensive for my family to eat, unless it's gone very stale. Of course, practically everything we eat is stale, says Peeta,
pulling the sleeping bag up around him. In less than a minute, he's snoring.
Huh. I always assumed the shopkeepers live a soft life.
And it's true. Peeta has always had enough to eat. But there's something kind of depressing about living your life on stale bread, the hard, dry loaves that no one else wanted.
One thing about us, since I bring our food home on a daily basis, most of it is so fresh you have to make sure it isn't going to make a run for it.
Somewhere during my shift, the rain stops, not gradually, but all at once. The downpour ends, and there's only the residual drippings of water from branches, the rush of the now overflowing stream below us. A full, beautiful moon emerges, and even without the glasses, I can see outside. I can't decide if the moon is real or merely a projection of the game makers. I know it was full shortly before I left home. Gail and I watched it rise as we hunted into the late hours.
How long have I been gone? I'm guessing it's been about 2 weeks in the arena, and there was that week of preparation in the capital.
Maybe the moon has completed its cycle.
For some reason, I badly want it to be my moon, the same one I see from the woods around District 12. That would give me something to cling to in the surreal world of the arena, where the authenticity of everything is to be doubted.
Four of us left. For the first time, I allow myself to truly think about the possibility that I might make it home, to fame, to wealth, to my own house in the Victor's Village. My mother and Prim would live there with me. No more fear of hunger, a new kind of freedom. But then, what? What would my life be like on a daily basis? Most of it has been consumed with the acquisition of food. Take that away, and I'm not really sure who I am, what my identity is. The idea scares me some. I think of Haymitch, with all his money. What did his life become? He lives alone, no wife or children, most of his waking hours drunk. I don't want to end up like that.
But you won't be alone,
I whisper to myself. I have my mother and Prim. Well, for the time being. And then, I don't want to think about then, when Prim has grown up, my mother passed away. I know I'll never marry, never risk bringing a child into the world, because if there's one thing being a Victor doesn't guarantee, it's your children's safety. My kids' names would go right into the reaping balls with everyone else's, and I swear I'll never let that happen. The sun eventually rises, its light slipping through the cracks and illuminating Peeta's face.
Who will he transform into if we make it home? This perplexing, good-natured boy, who can spin out lies so convincingly, the whole of Panem believes him to be hopelessly in love with me, and I'll admit it, there are moments when he makes me believe it myself. At least we'll be friends, I think. Nothing will change the fact that we've saved each other's lives in here, and beyond that, he will always be the boy with the bread. Good friends. Anything beyond that, though, and I feel Gale's gray eyes watching me, watching Peter, all the way from District 12. Discomfort causes me to move. I scoot over and shake Peter's shoulder. His eyes open sleepily, and when they focus on me, he pulls me down for a long kiss. We're wasting hunting time, I say when I finally break away.
I wouldn't call it wasting, he says, giving a big stretch as he sits up.
So do we hunt on empty stomachs to give us an edge?
Not us, I say. We stuff ourselves to give us staying power.
Count me in,
Peter says, but I can see he's surprised when I divide the rest of the stew and rice and hand a heaping plate to him. All this? We'll earn it back today, I say, and we both plow into our plates. Even cold, it's one of the best things I've ever tasted. I abandon my fork and scrape up the last dabs of gravy with my finger. I can feel Effie Trinket shuddering at my manners.
Hey, Effie, watch this, says Peter. He tosses his fork over his shoulder and literally licks his plate clean with his tongue, making loud, satisfied sounds. Then he blows a kiss out to her in general and calls, "We miss you, Effie!"
I cover his mouth with my hand, but I'm laughing.
"Stop! Gato could be right outside our cave!"
He grabs my hand away.
"What do I care? I've got you to protect me now," says Peter, pulling me to him.
"Come on," I say in exasperation, extricating myself from his grasp, but not before he gets in another kiss. Once we're packed up and standing outside our cave, our mood shifts to serious. It's as though for the last few days, sheltered by the rocks and the rain and Cato's preoccupation with Thresh, we were given a respite, a holiday of sorts. Now, although the day is sunny and warm, we both sense we're really back in the games. I hand Peter my knife, since whatever weapons he once had are long gone, and he slips it into his belt. My last 7 arrows, of the 12 I sacrificed 3 in the explosion, 2 at the feast, rattle a bit loosely in the quiver. I can't afford to lose any more.
"He'll be hunting us by now," says Peter. "Cato isn't one to wait for his prey to wander by."
"If he's wounded," I begin.
"It won't matter," Peter breaks in. "If he can move, he's coming."
With all the rain, the stream has overrun its banks by several feet on either side. We stop there to replenish our water. I check the snares I set days ago and come up empty, not surprising with the weather. Besides, I haven't seen many animals or signs of them in this area. "If we want food, we better head back up to my old hunting grounds," I say.
"Your call. Just tell me what you need me to do," Peter says.
"Keep an eye out," I say. "Stay on the rocks as much as possible. No sense in leaving him tracks to follow. And listen for both of us." It's clear at this point that the explosion destroyed the hearing in my left ear for good. I'd walk in the water to cover our tracks completely, but I'm not sure Peter's leg could take the current. Although the drugs have erased the infection, he's still pretty weak. My forehead hurts along the knife cut, but after 3 days the bleeding has stopped. I wear a bandage around my head, though, just in case physical exertion should bring it back. As we head up alongside the stream, we pass the place where I found Peter camouflaged in the weeds and mud. One good thing, between the downpour and the flooded banks,
all signs of his hiding place have been wiped out. That means that, if need be, we can come back to our cave. Otherwise, I wouldn't risk it with Cato after us. The boulders diminished to rocks that eventually turned to pebbles, and then, to my relief, we're back on pine needles and the gentle incline of the forest floor. For the first time, I realize we have a problem. Navigating the rocky terrain with a bad leg, well, you're naturally going to make some noise. But even on the smooth bed of needles, Peeta is loud. And I mean loud, loud. As if he's stomping his feet or something. I turn and look at him.
What?
He asks. You've got to move more quietly, I say. Forget about Cato. You're chasing off every rabbit in a 10-mile radius.
Really?
He says. Sorry, I didn't know. So we start up again, and he's a tiny bit better, but even with only one working ear, he's making me jump.
Can you take your boots off? I suggest.
Here? He asks in disbelief, as if I'd asked him to walk barefoot on hot coals or something. I have to remind myself that he's still not used to the woods, that it's the scary forbidden place beyond the fences of District 12. I think of Gale, with his velvet tread. It's eerie how little sound he makes, even when the leaves have fallen and it's a challenge to move at all without chasing off the game. I feel certain he's laughing back home.
Yes, I say patiently. I will too. That way we'll both be quieter.
Like I was making any noise. So we both strip off our boots and socks, and while there's some improvement, I could swear he's making an effort to snap every branch we encounter. Needless to say, although it takes several hours to reach my old camp with Rue, I've shot nothing. If the stream would settle down, fish might be an option, but the current is still too strong. As we stop to rest and drink water, I try to work out a solution. Ideally, I'd dump Peeta now with some simple root-gathering chore and go hunt, but then he'd be left with only a knife to defend himself against Cato's spears and superior strength. So what I'd really like is to try and conceal him somewhere safe, then go hunt, and come back and collect him. But I have a feeling his ego isn't going to go for that suggestion.
Katniss, he says, we need to split up. I know I'm chasing away the game.
Only because your legs hurt, I say generously, because really, you can tell that's only a small part of the problem.
I know, he says. So why don't you go on? Show me some plants to gather, and that way we'll both be useful.
Not if Cato comes and kills you. I tried to say it in a nice way, but it still sounds like I think he's a weakling. Surprisingly, he just laughs.
Look, I can handle Cato. I fought him before, didn't I?
Yeah, and that turned out great. You ended up dying in a mud bank. That's what I want to say, but I can't. He did save my life by taking on Cato, after all. I try another tactic.
What if you climbed up in a tree and acted as a lookout while I hunted?
I say, trying to make it sound like very important work.
What if you show me what's edible around here and go get us some meat?
He says, mimicking my tone.
Just don't go far, in case you need help.
I sigh and show him some roots to dig. We do need food, no question. One apple, two rolls, and a blob of cheese the size of a plum won't last long. I'll just go a short distance and hope Cato is a long way off. I teach him a bird whistle, not a melody like Rue's, but a simple two-note whistle, which we can use to communicate that we're all right. Fortunately, he's good at this. Leaving him with the pack, I head off. I feel like I'm 11 again, tethered not to the safety of the fence, but to Peeta, allowing myself 20, maybe 30 yards of hunting space. Away from him, though, the woods come alive with animal sounds. Reassured by his periodic whistles, I allow myself to drift farther away, and soon have two rabbits and a fat squirrel to show for it. I decide it's enough,
I can set snares and maybe get some fish. With Peeta's roots, this will be enough for now. As I travel the short distance back, I realize we haven't exchanged signals in a while. When my whistle receives no response, I run. In no time, I find the pack, a neat pile of roots beside it. The sheet of plastic has been laid on the ground where the sun can reach the single layer of berries that covers it. But where is he?
Peeta!
I call out in a panic.
Peeta!
I turn to the rustle of brush and almost send an arrow through him. Fortunately, I pull my bow at the last second and it sticks in an oak trunk to his left. He jumps back, flinging a handful of berries into the foliage. My fear comes out as anger.
What are you doing? You're supposed to be here, not running around in the woods.
I found some berries down by the stream, he says, clearly confused by my outburst.
I whistled. Why didn't you whistle back?
I snap at him. I didn't hear it. The water's too loud, I guess, he says. He crosses and puts his hands on my shoulders. That's when I feel that I'm trembling.
I thought Cato killed you,
I almost shout. No, I'm fine. Peeta wraps his arms around me, but I don't respond. Katniss. I push away, trying to sort out my feelings. If two people agree on a signal, they stay in range, because if one of them doesn't answer, they're in trouble, all right?
All right, he says.
All right, because that's what happened with Rue, and I watched her die,
I say. I turn away from him, go to the pack, and open a fresh bottle of water, although I still have some in mine, but I'm not ready to forgive him. I notice the food, the rolls and apples, are untouched. But someone's definitely picked away part of the cheese.
And you ate without me?
I really don't care. I just want something else to be mad about.
What? No, I didn't, Peeta says.
Oh, and I suppose the apples ate the cheese? I say. I don't know what ate the cheese, Peeta says slowly and distinctly, as if trying not to lose his temper. But it wasn't me. I've been down by the stream collecting berries. Would you care for some? I would, actually, but I don't want to relent too soon. I do walk over and look at them. I've never seen this type before. No, I have, but not in the arena. These aren't Rue's berries, although they resemble them. Nor do they match anything I learned about in training. I lean down and scoop up a few, rolling them between my fingers. My father's voice comes back to me.
Not these, Katniss. Never these. They're nightlock. You'll be dead before they reach your stomach.
Just then, the cannon fires. I whip around, expecting Peeta to collapse on the ground. But he only raises his eyebrows. The hovercraft appears 100 yards or so away. What's left of Foxface's emaciated body is lifted into the air. I can see the red glint of her hair in the sunlight. I should have known the moment I saw the missing cheese. Peeta has me by the arm, pushing me toward a tree. Climb. He'll be here in a second. We'll stand a better chance fighting him from above. I stop him, suddenly calm.
No, Peeta. She's your kill, not Cato's.
What? I haven't even seen her since the first day, he says. How could I have killed her? In answer, I hold out the berries. Chapter 24. It takes a while to explain the situation to Peeta, how Foxface stole the food from the supply pile before I blew it up. How she tried to take enough to stay alive, but not enough that anyone would notice it. How she wouldn't question the safety of berries we were preparing to eat ourselves.
I wonder how she found us, says Peeta. My fault, I guess, if I'm as loud as you say.
We were about as hard to follow as a herd of cattle, but I try to be kind.
And she's very clever, Peeta.
Well, she was. Until you outfoxed her.
Not on purpose. Doesn't seem fair somehow. I mean, we would have both been dead, too, if she hadn't eaten the berries first.
He checks himself.
No, of course, we wouldn't. You recognized them, didn't you?
I give a nod. We call them Nightlock.
Even the name sounds deadly, he says. I'm sorry, Katniss. I really thought they were the same ones you'd gathered.
Don't apologize. It just means we're one step closer to home, right? I ask.
I'll get rid of the rest, Peeta says. He gathers up the sheet of blue plastic, careful to trap the berries inside, and goes to toss them into the woods.
Wait, I cry. I find the leather pouch that belonged to the boy from District 1 and fill it with a few handfuls of berries from the plastic. If they fooled Foxface, maybe they can fool Kato as well. If he's chasing us or something, we can act like we accidentally dropped the pouch, and if he eats them...
Then hello, District 12, says Peeta.
That's it, I say, securing the pouch to my belt.
He'll know where we are now, says Peeta. If he was anywhere nearby and saw that hovercraft, he'll know we killed her and come after us.
Peeta's right. This could be just the opportunity Kato's been waiting for. But even if we run now, there's the meat to cook, and our fire will be another sign of our whereabouts. Let's make a fire, right now. I begin to gather branches and brush.
Are you ready to face him? Peeta asks.
I'm ready to eat. Better to cook our food while we have the chance. If he knows we're here, he knows. But he also knows there's two of us, and probably assumes we were hunting Foxface.
That means you're recovered. And the fire means we're not hiding. We're inviting him here.
Would you show up? I ask.
Maybe not, he says.
Peeta's a whiz with fires, coaxing a blaze out of the damp wood. In no time, I have the rabbits and squirrel roasting, the roots wrapped in leaves, baking in the coals. We take turns gathering greens and keeping a careful watch for Kato, but as I anticipated, he doesn't make an appearance. When the food's cooked, I pack most of it up, leaving us each a rabbit's leg to eat as we walk. I want to move higher into the woods, climb a good tree, and make camp for the night, but Peeta resists.
I can't climb like you, Katniss, especially with my leg, and I don't think I could ever fall asleep 50 feet above the ground.
It's not safe to stay in the open, Peeta, I say.
Can't we go back to the cave? He asks. It's near water and easy to defend.
I sigh. Several more hours of walking, or should I say crashing, through the woods to reach an area we'll just have to leave in the morning to hunt. But Peeta doesn't ask for much. He's followed my instructions all day, and I'm sure if things were reversed, he wouldn't make me spend the night in a tree. It dawns on me that I haven't been very nice to Peeta today, nagging him about how loud he was, screaming at him over disappearing. The playful romance we had sustained in the cave has disappeared out in the open, under the hot sun, with the threat of Kato looming over us. Haymitch has probably just about had it with me. And as for the audience, I reach up and give him a kiss.
Sure, let's go back to the cave.
He looks pleased and relieved.
Well, that was easy.
I work my arrow out of the oak, careful not to damage the shaft. These arrows are food, safety, and life itself now. We toss a bunch more wood on the fire. It should be sending off smoke for a few more hours, although I doubt Kato assumes anything at this point. When we reach the stream, I see the water has dropped considerably and moves at its old leisurely pace, so I suggest we walk back in it. Peeta's happy to oblige, and since he's a lot quieter in water than on land,
It's a doubly good idea. It's a long walk back to the cave, though, even going downward, even with the rabbit to give us a boost. We're both exhausted by our hike today, and still way too underfed. I keep my bow loaded, both for Cato and any fish I might see, but the stream seems strangely empty of creatures. By the time we reach our destination, our feet are dragging and the sun sits low on the horizon. We fill up our water bottles and climb the little slope to our den. It's not much, but out here in the wilderness, it's the closest thing we have to a home. It will be warmer than a tree, too, because it provides some shelter from the wind that has begun to blow steadily in from the west. I set a good dinner out, but halfway through, Peeta begins to nod off. After days of inactivity, the hunt has taken its toll. I order him into the sleeping bag and set aside the rest of his food for when he wakes. He drops off immediately. I pull the sleeping bag up to his chin and kiss his forehead, not for the audience, but for me, because I'm so grateful that he's still here, not dead by the stream as I'd thought. So glad that I don't have to face Cato alone. Brutal, bloody Cato, who can snap a neck with a twist of his arm, who had the power to overcome Thresh, who has had it out for me since the beginning. He probably has had a special hatred for me ever since I outscored him in training. A boy like Peeta would simply shrug that off, but I have a feeling it drove Cato to distraction, which is not that hard. I think of his ridiculous reaction to finding the supplies blown up. The others were upset, of course, but he was completely unhinged. I wonder now if Cato might not be entirely sane. The sky lights up with the seal, and I watch Foxface shine in the sky and then disappear from the world forever. He hasn't said it, but I don't think Peeta felt good about killing her, even if it was essential. I can't pretend I'll miss her, but I have to admire her. My guess is, if they had given us some sort of test, she would have been the smartest of all the tributes. If, in fact, we had been setting a trap for her, I bet she'd have sensed it and avoided the berries. It was Peeta's own ignorance that brought her down. I've spent so much time making sure I don't underestimate my opponents that I've forgotten it's just as dangerous to overestimate them as well. That brings me back to Cato. But while I think I had a sense of Foxface, who she was and how she operated, he's a little more slippery, powerful, well-trained, but smart? I don't know. Not like she was, and utterly lacking in the control Foxface demonstrated. I believe Cato could easily lose his judgment in a fit of temper. Not that I can feel superior on that point. I think of the moment I sent the arrow flying into the apple in the pig's mouth when I was so enraged. Maybe I do understand Cato better than I think. Despite the fatigue in my body, my mind's alert, so I let Peeta sleep long past our usual switch. In fact, a soft gray day has begun when I shake his shoulder. He looks out, almost in alarm. I slept the whole night. That's not fair, Katniss. You should have woken me. I stretch and burrow down into the bag. I'll sleep now. Wake me if anything interesting happens. Apparently nothing does, because when I open my eyes, bright hot afternoon light gleams through the rocks. Any sign of our friend? I ask. Peeta shakes his head. No, he's keeping a disturbingly low profile. How long do you think we'll have before the game makers drive us together? I ask. Well, Foxface died almost a day ago, so there's been plenty of time for the audience to place bets and get bored. I guess it could happen at any moment, says Peeta. Yeah, I have a feeling today's the day, I say. I sit up and look out at the peaceful terrain. I wonder how they'll do it. Peeta remains silent. There's not really any good answer. Well, until they do, no sense in wasting a hunting day.
but we should probably eat as much as we can hold, just in case we run into trouble, I say.
Peeta packs up our gear while I lay out a big meal. The rest of the rabbits, roots, greens, the rolls spread with the last bit of cheese. The only thing I leave in reserve is the squirrel and the apple. By the time we're done, all that's left is a pile of rabbit bones. My hands are greasy, which only adds to my growing feeling of grubbiness. Maybe we don't bathe daily in the seam, but we keep cleaner than I have of late. Except for my feet, which have walked in the stream, I'm covered in a layer of grime. Leaving the cave has a sense of finality about it. I don't think there will be another night in the arena somehow. One way or the other, dead or alive, I have the feeling I'll escape it today. I give the rocks a pat goodbye, and we head down to the stream to wash up. I can feel my skin itching for the cool water. I may do my hair and braid it back wet. I'm wondering if we might even be able to give our clothes a quick scrub when we reach the stream, or what used to be the stream. Now there's only a bone-dry bed. I put my hand down to feel it. Not even a little damp. They must have drained it while we slept, I say. A fear of the cracked tongue, aching body, and fuzzy mind brought on by my previous dehydration creeps into my consciousness. Our bottles and skin are fairly full, but with two drinking and this hot sun, it won't take long to deplete them.
The lake, says Peeta. That's where they want us to go.
Maybe the ponds still have some, I say hopefully.
We can check, he says, but he's just humoring me. I'm humoring myself, because I know what I'll find when we return to the pond where I soaked my leg. A dusty, gaping mouth of a hole. But we make the trip anyway, just to confirm what we already know.
You're right. They're driving us to the lake, I say, where there's no cover, where they're guaranteed a bloody fight to the death with nothing to block their view.
Do you want to go straight away, or wait until the water's tapped out?
Let's go now, while we've had food and rest. Let's just go end this thing, he says.
I nod. It's funny. I feel almost as if it's the first day of the games again, that I'm in the same position. 21 tributes are dead, but I still have yet to kill Cato. And really, wasn't he always the one to kill? Now it seems the other tributes were just minor obstacles, distractions, keeping us from the real battle of the games, Cato and me. But no, there's the boy waiting beside me. I feel his arms wrap around me.
2 against 1 should be a piece of cake, he says.
Next time we eat, it will be in the capital, I answer.
You bet it will, he says.
We stand there a while, locked in an embrace, feeling each other, the sunlight, the rustle of the leaves at our feet. Then, without a word, we break apart and head for the lake. I don't care now that Peeta's footfalls send rodents scurrying, make birds take wing. We have to fight Cato, and I'd just as soon do it here as on the plain. But I doubt I'll have that choice. If the game makers want us in the open, then in the open we will be. We stop to rest for a few moments under the tree where the careers trapped me, the husk of the tracker-jacker nest beaten to a pulp by the heavy rains and dried in the burning sun, confirms the location. I touch it with the tip of my boot, and it dissolves into dust that is quickly carried off by the breeze. I can't help looking up in the tree where Rue secretly perched, waiting to save my life. Tracker-jackers, Glimmer's bloated body, the terrifying hallucinations. Let's move on, I say, wanting to escape the darkness that surrounds this place. Peeta doesn't object. Given our late start to the day, when we reach the plain, it's already early evening. There's no sign of Cato, no sign of anything,
except the gold cornucopia, glowing in the slanting sun rays. Just in case Cato decided to pull a fox face on us, we circle the cornucopia to make sure it's empty. Then, obediently, as if following instructions, we cross to the lake and fill our water containers. I frown at the shrinking sun. We don't want to fight him after dark. There's only the one pair of glasses. Peter carefully squeezes drops of iodine into the water.
Maybe that's what he's waiting for. What do you want to do? Go back to the cave?
Either that or find a tree. But let's give him another half an hour or so. Then we'll take cover, I answer. We sit by the lake in full sight. There's no point in hiding now. In the trees at the edge of the plain, I can see the mockingjays flitting about, bouncing melodies back and forth between them like brightly colored balls. I open my mouth and sing out Rue's four-note run. I can feel them pause curiously at the sound of my voice, listening for more. I repeat the notes in the silence. First one mockingjay trills the tune back, then another. Then the whole world comes alive with the sound.
Just like your father, says Peeta.
My fingers find the pin on my shirt. That's Rue's song, I say. I think they remember it. The music swells, and I recognize the brilliance of it. As the notes overlap, they complement one another, forming a lovely, unearthly harmony. It was this sound then, thanks to Rue, that sent the orchard workers of District 11 home each night. Does someone start it at quitting time, I wonder, now that she is dead? For a while, I just close my eyes and listen, mesmerized by the beauty of the song. Then something begins to disrupt the music. Runs cut off in jagged, imperfect lines. Dissonant notes intersperse with the melody. The mockingjays' voices rise up in a shrieking cry of alarm. We're on our feet, Peeta wielding his knife, me poised to shoot, when Cato smashes through the trees and bears down on us. He has no spear. In fact, his hands are empty, yet he runs straight for us. My first arrow hits his chest and inexplicably falls aside. He's got some kind of body armor, I shout to Peeta. Just in time, too, because Cato is upon us. I brace myself, but he rockets right between us with no attempt to check his speed. I can tell from his panting, the sweat pouring off his purplish face, that he's been running hard a long time, not toward us, from something. But what? My eyes scan the woods just in time to see the first creature leap onto the plain. As I'm running away, I see another half-dozen join it. Then I am stumbling blindly after Cato with no thought of anything but to save myself. Chapter 25 Mutations. No question about it. I've never seen these mutts. But they're no natural-born animals. They resemble huge wolves. But what wolf lands, and then balances easily on its hind legs? What wolf waves the rest of the pack forward, with its front paw, as though it had a wrist? These things I can see at a distance. Up close, I'm sure their more menacing attributes will be revealed. Cato has made a beeline for the cornucopia, and without question I follow him. If he thinks it's the safest place, who am I to argue? Besides, even if I could make it to the trees, it would be impossible for Peeta to outrun them on that leg. Peeta! My hands have just landed on the metal at the pointed tail of the cornucopia when I remember I'm part of a team. He's about 15 yards behind me, hobbling as fast as he can, but the mutts are closing in on him fast. I send an arrow into the pack, and one goes down— but there are plenty to take its place. Peeta's waving me up the horn. Go, Katniss, go! He's right. I can't protect either of us on the ground. I start climbing, scaling the cornucopia on my hands and feet. The pure gold surface has been designed to resemble the woven horn that we fill at harvest, so there are little ridges and seams to get a decent hold on. but after a day in the arena sun, the metal feels hot enough to blister my hands. Kato lies on his side at the very top of the horn, 20 feet above the ground, gasping to catch his breath as he gags over the edge. Now's my chance to finish him off. I stop midway up the horn and load another arrow, but just as I'm about to let it fly, I hear Peter cry out. I twist around and see he's just reached the tail, and the mutts are right on his heels.
"Climb!"
I yell. Peter starts up, hampered by not only the leg, but the knife in his hand. I shoot my arrow down the throat of the first mutt that places its paws on the metal. As it dies, the creature lashes out, inadvertently opening gashes on a few of its companions. That's when I get a look at the claws. 4 inches, and clearly razor sharp. Peter reaches my feet, and I grab his arm and pull him along. Then I remember Kato waiting at the top and whip around, but he's doubled over with cramps and apparently more preoccupied with the mutts than us. He coughs out something unintelligible. The snuffling, growling sound coming from the mutts isn't helping.
"What?"
I shout at him. He said, "Can they climb it?" answers Peter, drawing my focus back to the base of the horn. The mutts are beginning to assemble. As they join together, they raise up again to stand easily on their back legs, giving them an eerily human quality. Each has a thick coat, some with fur that is straight and sleek, others curly, and the colors vary from jet black to what I can only describe as blonde. There's something else about them, something that makes the hair rise up on the back of my neck, but I can't put my finger on it. They put their snouts in the horn, sniffing and tasting the metal, scraping paws over the surface and then making high-pitched yipping sounds to one another. This must be how they communicate, because the pack backs up, as if to make room. Then one of them, a good-sized mutt with silky waves of blonde fur, takes a running start and leaps onto the horn. Its back legs must be incredibly powerful, because it lands a mere 10 feet below us, its pink lips pulled back in a snarl. For a moment, it hangs there, and in that moment I realize what else unsettled me about the mutts. The green eyes glowering at me are unlike any dog or wolf, any canine I've ever seen. They are unmistakably human. And that revelation has barely registered when I notice the collar with the number 1 inlaid with jewels, and the whole horrible thing hits me. The blonde hair, the green eyes, the number. It's Glimmer. A shriek escapes my lips, and I'm having trouble holding the arrow in place. I've been waiting to fire, only too aware of my dwindling supply of arrows, waiting to see if the creatures can, in fact, climb. But now, even though the mutt has begun to slide backward, unable to find any purchase on the metal, even though I can hear the slow screeching of the claws like nails on a blackboard, I fire into its throat. Its body twitches and flops onto the ground with a thud.
Katniss!
I can feel Peeta's grip on my arm.
It's her!
I get out.
Who?
Asks Peeta. My head snaps from side to side as I examine the pack, taking in the various sizes and colors. The small one with the red coat and amber eyes, fox face. And there, the ashen hair and hazel eyes of the boy from District 9, who died as we struggled for the backpack. And worst of all, the smallest mutt, with dark glossy fur, huge brown eyes, and a collar that reads 11 in woven straw, teeth bared in hatred. Rue.
What is it, Katniss?
Peter shakes my shoulder.
It's them. It's all of them, the others, Rue and Foxface, and all of the other tributes.
I choke out. I hear Peter's gasp of recognition.
What did they do to them? You don't think those could be their real eyes?
Their eyes are the least of my worries. What about their brains? Have they been given any of the real tributes' memories? Have they been programmed to hate our faces particularly because we have survived and they were so callously murdered? And the ones we actually killed, do they believe they're avenging their own deaths?
Before I can get this out, the mutts begin a new assault on the horn. They've split into two groups at the sides of the horn and are using those powerful hindquarters to launch themselves at us.